No, I mean, hey, I want constructive, any kind of feedback, that's okay. Even if you guys did hate me, it would be okay.
Impossible to.
Thanks! That's what I like to hear. How could you say that? When I say such glowing things about, we had a teacher meeting, and I was telling them how much I loved this class and how fun it is having all guys in the class. I actually really like it. So, anyways.
We had one.
But you guys are really interactive.
Her off. Except
yeah, you guys freaked her out.
Yeah. Except for those that one time when you were just like putting down guys the whole time. And
oh, yeah.
And I was like, man, you're
going to
like.
When was that? Stop it. For a second, I was thinking back on like, man.
Well, you were talking about in Seattle. That's what it was.
Oh, whenever I talk about sports, that's what I'm talking about. Oh, gosh, we're about to start the recording with sports again. I'm not going to let it go there. Maybe like 3 or 4 weeks in a row. Okay, so hard to teach during football season. That was great.
Lord, thank you so much for this time. And I do thank you for this class, Lord, and thank you for each guy in here, Lord, and just what you're doing in their lives, God, and even just as I get to hear, like, reading their homework and just during class time, Lord, the things that you're doing in their lives and how you're using them, God, in their workplaces and their families and how you're equipping and building them for what you have for them. Thank you for that, God, and just bless them. Continue to bless them in their studies and in their work and in their family life and everything they do. Thank you so much, God, that that we get to hang out once a week, and I pray that this would be a fruitful time, Lord, an informative time, but also inspiring, Lord, as we continue to look at some of the people that you used during the 1800s, God, the men and women that you raised up and that you did a great work through because they were simply available to you. Lord, may it encourage us, may it inspire, convict even, Lord, and challenge us in Jesus' name.
Amen.
Amen. Okay. So, obviously, last week we began our discussion of what I kind of broadly call the missionary era, right? Because mission and outreach was one of the most key characteristics, key components of this time period for the church, or for the church during this time. And that's why it's my favorite. So, I mean, I could honestly harp on this for weeks because the 17 and 1800s are like the best time in history as far as I'm concerned because of what the Lord was doing in that time. We saw, and again, because I called it the missionary era because, like I said, the characteristic was missions, and the great missions movement, great missionary revival of this time was really sparked by who? Anyone
Mary Slessor.
Something we talked about.
The shoemaker.
The
shoemaker,
the shoemaker,
yeah.
The shoemaker, get it out. William Carey, okay. Thank you, Roland. William Carey, and even before him, there was a group of people. Do you remember the group of people? They were part of the Pietist movement. Start with an M.
Moravians,
yes. Good. All right, that's all right. Well, these guys are getting it and learning. I don't
know what
else.
So, yes.
All right, the Moravians, right? So the Moravians were the ones who really kind of got the ball rolling as far as Protestant missions was concerned. But then, of course, William Carey was the real catalyst for getting things going, and the real mover and shaker, kind of again like the Martin Luther of the Reformation. You know, there were all the people that kind of led up to it, like the Moravians, you know, but then Carey was the one who really took the ball and ran. And so, to use a nice football term. So, William Carey takes a missionary voyage to India in 1793, and this led to a huge flood of missions volunteers who, sacrificed all, basically, to go and serve the Lord in foreign lands. And so, naturally, when you see this kind of an outpouring of, obviously, love for God translated into love for mankind and desire to see the gospel spread, you see in that, I think, a very good picture of what Jesus commended the Church of Philadelphia for in the book of Revelation, you know, having that brotherly love, that compassion, just that fruitfulness in their lives and in their ministry. And, you know, Jesus commended the Church of Philadelphia, saying, you've kept my word, you have not denied my name, you've kept my command to persevere. They kept his commands, they obeyed the Lord. And really, you know, we can even see in that they kept Jesus' command in Matthew 28 to go into all the world and preach the gospel to all nations. They were definitely very obedient to the Great Commission. And so I think that's a really, the missionary era is a really good picture I guess you could say, of what Jesus commanded in the Church of Philadelphia in Revelation as well. So we're going to start today by kind of just picking up where we left off. I had a few more little biographical sketches I wanted to do with a couple more missionaries. And then we're going to move on and talk about some other key figures on the home front in Europe and America that God used as well. So, because I there's just a couple people that I was just like, man, I can't leave them out.
This
so,
is like after David Livingston. And
this is after David Livingston, exactly. So, I mean, roughly, I don't know if they all are necessarily. But it's because, I mean, I'm kind of going by continent here. You know, we have William Carey and Admiral Judson in Asia and Henry Martin and, you know, those guys in India, Asia, that area. And then David Livingston and Robert Moffat were in Africa. And now we're going to pick up here with Mary Slessor, who was also in Africa. And so Mary Slessor was inspired by Livingston's example, actually. And she almost single-handedly opened up the Nigerian coast of Africa to the gospel and to the West.
Inspired by who?
Livingston. David Livingston, who we talked about last week. So I usually, you know, if I would have had time last week, which I didn't, I went way over as it is, but if I would have time, I would have linked them together, because I usually do. I'll talk about Livingston and then follow it up with Mary Slessor, because there were so many interesting parallels in their lives and ministries and things. I mean, for one thing, you know, not only was, you know, she in Africa like he was, she was also the same nationality. She was Scottish. In fact, she's become one of Scotland's best-loved historical figures, just like Livingston was. And, like Livingston, she is on the Scottish currency. She's on the £10 note currently. Previously, it's interesting, Livingston...
Where was he?
Livingston's on the old £10 note, and then when they redid the £10 note, they put Mary Slessor on it. So I thought that's kind of cool, in a way. Whether the Scots realize it or not, which they usually don't, they've got these, you know, real... bow to missions on their currency. I thought that was kind of interesting. So, like I said, Mary in many ways is a parallel to David Livingston. In fact, her early life paralleled his in many ways. Like him, she was raised in the mills and the factories in Scotland. She rose above her situation through education and through studying the Word of God, just like he did. But Mary had a slightly different... childhood than Livingston on one level, because Livingston was raised in a real godly, solid Christian home. And Mary Slessor had a godly mother. She was a wonderful woman. I mean, she's just, you know, amazing. But her dad was an alcoholic. He fell into alcoholism when Mary was really young, and that caused a lot of stress and strain on the family. He spent all of his money at the pubs, and as a result, it forced Mary and her mom to have to go work in the mills, because Mary was the oldest child. She had an older brother, but he died pretty young, and so she ended up working with her mom in the factories to try to raise enough money to support the rest of the kids, the rest of the family. You know, and so that was a very difficult, trying situation to have to work through and deal with. Not only that, but so often, you know, they'd be scrimping and saving, trying to make ends meet to prepare just, you know, even just preparing dinner every night was like a major undertaking and a you know, I wouldn't want to say it was a treat, but, you know, anytime they could get a good meal on the table, it was like, yes. And so often, unfortunately, they would do this. They'd prepare, you know, save money, get food and everything. And then dad would come home drunk, take the food, and just chuck it into the fire because he was just out of it and angry and whatever. And so, I mean, waste all of that hard work and hard-earned food. And so, I mean, just frustrating things. A lot of times he would force Mary. It's not very clear in her biography. I think they were trying to be tasteful, but he would force her. She basically forced to go out into the streets at night and wander around and then go sleep somewhere in an alley and then get up in the morning and go back to work. It's not clear. I'm assuming there was, if not mental or emotional abuse, there was probably physical abuse of some sort as well that was going on as a result of his drinking. And so lots of really difficult things she was forced to deal with from the time she was about 9 or 10 years old, very young. But her relationship with Jesus from the time she was a little girl really, really carried her through these kinds of things. And it's neat because instead of getting really hard-hearted and bitter, which she totally could have done, you would even have look at her and say, well, she has a right to be bitter. Look at that creep she had for a dad, right? But instead of getting hardened by these things, she allowed the Lord to make her more soft and more sensitive to the needs of others and to use her sorrow to minister and to comfort others who were going through similar situations, because as we're going to see during this time with all the factories and mills, there's a lot of drinking, a lot of, you know, alcoholism, a lot of other kinds of issues going on in the cities during that time. And so, so there are a lot of other people in similar situations to what Mary was facing and dealing with. And so it's cool how she allowed the Lord to use it in her life for good. There's that old saying, and I quote this all the time, the same fire that hardens wax, or softens clay, hardens wax. And that's very true, I think, of the trials in our lives. What?
Yes, softens
wax. Softens wax, hardens clay. Is that what I said?
No.
Okay, the same fire that hardens clay softens wax.
Yeah.
There, no better?
Yeah.
Okay. I have it written in my notes. I could have just read it. I'm trying to go off. Trying to ad-lib. We'll skip that. Never let that happen again. So, but it's true, you know, if you think about it, right, the fire trials in our lives, as we're heated, you know, as the trials are heated up under us, we have a choice what kind of material we're going to be, whether we're going to be clay that becomes hardened and bitter and angry and the world done me wrong and God doesn't love me and all that, or we can be like wax and allow it to soften us and allow our hearts to be shaped and molded by the Lord for his purposes, for good, and for fruitfulness. And so that's what we see with Mary's life. And I think she's just a beautiful picture of that because she had to deal with, you know, anger and bitterness. Of course, she's human, you know, but she didn't allow that to dominate her life. She allowed the Lord to work a victory through her where she could have ended up being just this bitter old woman. God, you know, did a great work through her because of how she chose to let him use it. And so in her late teens, she began working for a mission with some of the rough and tough kids, I guess the mid-1800s version of gang kids, gangbangers, in the slums of their town, Dundee, that they lived in. And because she was so, like, bold with these kids and very forthright, just kind of, you know, tell it to them straight and no nonsense and, you know, I'm here to stay, I'm committed to working with you guys, because of the attitude that she had and because of her care and her desire to reach these kids, they really grew to respect and love her. A lot of other missions workers and other, you know, do-gooders would come and be like, okay, I want to help you, but keep you at arm's length, you know, and they didn't really care about these kids. And they could tell that Mary had a different approach, that there was something in her that really wanted to connect with them and treat them as people, as individuals who needed a savior. And
yeah,
so they responded.
That's what's on the bill. There's a little kid.
That's later. That's when she was actually on the mission field.
And that's a little lamb at the bottom, right?
Is there a lamb?
Mary had a little lamb.
Mary had a little lamb, cute. That's where that song came from. Thank you. I was going to get to that. Yeah, and the song Mary Had a Little Lamb was inspired by this currency. Okay, now. All right, so anyways. She was actually, you know, you would think that everybody would be commend her for, like, reaching out to these kids, but she was very unconventional in that day because this is Victorian Britain, and ladies, you know, or young women, you know, didn't go out on the streets and try to reach kids, especially these young teenage boys, you know. It's like, that's improper, and I can't believe you're doing that, and blah, blah, blah. And so even though she was very unconventional, she was probably the most effective worker they had at the mission because she was the one that really connected with these kids and brought so many of them to Christ because she was so committed to helping them and to being with them. This work, I don't have time to get way into all of the details, but even though it was challenging and, again, unconventional what she did, it was preparing and equipping her to minister boldly and confidently later on once she went to Africa. And so how that came about was Mary and her mom, they'd always loved foreign missions, especially this region of West Africa that they'd heard so much about called Calabar. It's actually still called Calabar today, but it's now part of present-day Nigeria. But if you look on a map, sometimes I've seen it before maps where it says Calabar on there. And I have a friend from Nigeria, and he said, that's that area. And he totally knows who Mary Slessor is and everything, too, which is kind of neat. But anyway, they learned about her in school. So it was a very little known area at the time. All that was known was it was full of disease and wild animals. There were tribes there that were so savage that nobody had ever really been able to penetrate beyond the coast. There were a couple mission stations set up by this time on the coast. You know, again, Livingston had already gone into Africa and other people had also been there. And so people went to the coast, but then they didn't really get much further than that. And so Calabar was kind of this mystery region, but very dangerous and very scary. But even though, you know, Mary heard all these horrible things and how dangerous it was and what a scary place Calabar was, she just had in her heart for years, since she was a kid, the desire to go there. But she just kind of prayed and waited on the Lord with it. Like, okay, God, I don't know if this is you or not. I'm going to wait on it and just see if you bring it to pass. And then in 1876, she was actually given the opportunity to go. Long story short, God just opened doors and made a way, and she felt like, this is time for me to go. And so, like Livingston, Mary soon realized that working with the missionaries on the coast was not really her thing. She wanted to go further and further into the interior. She's like, let's go where nobody has brought the gospel yet. Why are we all just hanging out here where it's comfortable and easy? You know, we need to reach more people. David Livingston had once said, I am willing to go anywhere provided it be forward. And she just kind of took that motto on for herself as well. I'll go anywhere as long as I'm moving forward. I don't want to just sit here, and I don't want to regress and go into ground that's already been covered. I want to go forward to where the gospel has not been proclaimed. And so she kind of made that her own motto throughout her life. She was very inspired by Livingstone, which is kind of neat to see the next generation here going out. So after several years trying to serve on the coast in Duketown, she was assigned to an outstation further inland called Old Town. You know, real creative names they came up with here. And that was, you know, she was stoked on this because she got to be, you know, on her own, doing her own thing, and, you know, really reaching out to people that were unreached. But I think they were also kind of happy to get rid of her at the mission stations on the coast because she was kind of a handful. Like, nobody really knew what to do with her because she was, again, unconventional. And she would go do things that nobody else was willing to do or wanted to do or thought appropriate. And so... I guess they had a really hard time kind of controlling her. She was like this crazy, like short girl. She's like really short. You can't tell from that dress. The dress is probably bigger than she is. She was like 5 foot tall or something, little redhead. She had reportedly climbed every tree in the area and was very uncivilized. And so, you know, really, I mean, this is, again, an 1800s girl, like out, you know, doing the Tarzan thing through the jungles. And so people kind of didn't know how to handle her. But now that she was kind of on her own...
Almost 30 years old.
Huh?
Almost 30 years old.
Yeah, she's just going for it.
That's awesome.
And so so from the new station she was at, you know, she was able to kind of live and work as she pleased and have the freedom to do what she wanted. And so she lived, you know, she just lived among the African people. She's like, there's no, why am I going to sit in a little mission house by myself, segregated from them? So she lived in a mud hut. She ate the local food. And... she also, by doing that, she was able to save a lot of her missionary money, and amazingly, she sent a lot of her money back home to her family in Scotland. By now, her dad had died, and her mom was alone raising the rest of the kids. So isn't that crazy to think of a missionary getting their support and sending it right back to their family at home? Yeah. So, I mean, they just had such a different concept than we do of ministry and money and stuff. You know, I mean, it just was all like open hand before the Lord. Like, God, if I don't need this, I'm going to give it to somebody who does. It's like, wow. I really appreciate that. But I still see that sometimes in missionaries today that I know, that they just, they're very grateful people. And so they're also very giving. And I see that a lot, that they're not all caught up in like, what am I getting out of this? And, you know, saving and hoarding and stuff. They're just so willing to give because the Lord's given to them and they recognize that. And I think it's just really sweet that she had that kind of a mentality. So she was described as the barefoot, scantily clad, red-haired, working-class woman who lived African style in a mud hovel, her face at times covered with boils and often without her false teeth. I don't even want to know. So this must have been a before shot, and I don't know what that, yeah, anyway, she put her teeth in for that picture, so when she got back home. Anyway, so, I mean, she was a little bit on the gnarly side, but, you know, again, that... she didn't care. She was there to just be among the people, and it wasn't about, like, making sure I keep my English appearance, my British appearance. I'm living in Africa. I want to be as approachable as possible to these people. And so she supervised schools. She gave medical aid. She became a mother to unwanted children, especially to twins. Twins were said to be cursed with evil spirits, and so whenever twins were born, a lot of times what they would do in the tribes is they would... break the baby's backs and throw them in clay pots and chuck them out into the forest for the wild animals to eat because they thought, oh, twins are evil, kill them. So, I mean, they just did a lot of, that's not even the worst of it. They did a lot of really horrific stuff. And so, you know, she would rescue some of these kids before they were killed or left out to die. She mediated a lot of disputes between tribes, and so she developed quite a reputation for herself because she was helping meet a lot of practical needs in the community and in the tribes that she was working with, as well as bringing the gospel, of course. That was, of course, her first and foremost thing, but the Lord used, it's cool how the Lord used those practical means of ministry as vehicles for the gospel. And so in August of 1888, she decided to move further into the interior, into an even more dangerous region that nobody had gone to at all before, the Akoyong region. No white person had ever lived there before. Some had tried and not succeeded. And so she felt, you know, what probably needs to happen is a woman needs to go in there because that would be less threatening to them than a man. You know, and we think totally the opposite. And it's like, I would not send a woman out there because it's more dangerous. We need to send a man. But in her mind, she thought, no, I'll be more approachable. I'll be more welcome to them because they won't think I'm a threat. And, you know, really, she was right, I think, because that proved to be the fact. She was very, very effective ministering there among the Akoyong. And so she continued basically doing what she'd been doing before. But it was really her effectiveness as a peacemaker between these tribes, the tribes of the Akoyong region, that spread her reputation. I mean, they would get in fights and wars over the craziest things. You know, the witch doctor of one tribe would pronounce blame on another tribe if, like, the chief's son died or something bad happened. He'd say, oh, it's because this other tribe over here cursed you. Well, that other tribe was just sitting around minding their own business. They didn't actually do anything. But all of a sudden, these guys are like, oh, they come running in and just start killing everyone. Nobody ever knew what, okay, why are we fighting? What's going on? So it was super, like, chaotic and, you know, just haphazard. There was no rhyme or reason to any of this. And so, you know, I don't have time to get into the details, but it's amazing, like literally miraculous, how she was able to go and intervene in these tribal disputes and keep these guys from fighting one another. And her reputation grew to the point where she was eventually named a judge for the entire region. They would bring all their cases to her and issues and stuff. In 1892, she was appointed the first British vice consul to that whole part of Africa. And also with the help of a Christian chief, from the coastal region, his name was King Ayo Honesty, and with his help, Mary was able to basically open up the whole Akoyong region to the west by establishing trusts and establishing trade relations between the Akoyong inland tribes and the coastal tribes. Prior to this, they had all been afraid of each other. Everybody, not even just the Europeans and the white people, but even other Africans were afraid of the Akoyong. But now, because of Mary and this Christian chief, they were able to build a bridge and connect inland Africa, inland West Africa, to the coast. And so, like Livingston, Mary didn't see very many converts in her lifetime, although there were apparently several churches established. She wasn't really that concerned because she really viewed her ministry like Livingston did, as a foundation-laying ministry, paving the way for others who would follow in her footsteps, clearing away the brush, as it were. And so she really did an effective job of that. She, you know, again, opened up that whole region so that other missionaries could go in and bring the gospel to that part of Africa. And so Mary went home to be with the Lord in 1915 after becoming one of Africa's greatest pioneer missionaries. And really explorers, too, because like Livingston, she pushed inland as far as she could. Quote, her success as a missionary pioneer was amazing, and the oneness that she felt for the Africans has been equaled by few. The greatest tribute she ever received was paid to her before her death by fellow missionaries who knew her well, and in spite of her faults and eccentricities, they honored her as a great woman of God. So, that's Mary Slessor. And then we have, it's so hard for me not to like go off and like tell all these extra stories. We got to keep moving though to cover everybody. I leave that to you. You guys need to read these stories for yourselves. Highly, highly, highly recommend it. Robert Morrison, he was the very first Protestant missionary to China. So we're going to keep moving around the globe here a little bit, going from Africa over to China. And he did a major pioneering work there in preparation for future missionary greats. He was born in England, and he developed an interest in missions when he was pretty young. And so after his mom died, he began training for ministry. He applied to the London Missionary Society in 1804, when he was about 22. And he really saw a great need in China, again, because there weren't any Protestant missions there. We know that the Jesuits had gone there back in the 16th century, and so there was some knowledge in some areas of China of the Christian faith on some level, but I mean, other than that, there was nothing. And so he really saw a great need there. And even though nobody would help him to get there, the East India Company, you know, definitely wouldn't help him, even though he asked them for it. And even though he couldn't find anyone who was interested in going with him, he decided, well, I guess I just have to go alone. I know this is a burden from the Lord. I know this is what he's called me to do. So if I have to go by myself with no support, other than, you know, what the Missionary Society can give me, if I have to go without a team, I'm going to just do it. So he went alone in January of 1807 and headed for Canton. And at this time, he had a conversation with the ship owner, and the ship owner said, "So, Mr. Morrison, you really expect to make an impression on the idolatry of the great Chinese Empire?" And Morrison said, "No, but I expect that God will, sir." And so that was really all he went out with, was just like, God's going to make an impression, God's going to do something. Just that simple childlike faith. Very cool. So when he arrived, he actually had a very elementary knowledge of Chinese, you know, just basic phrases and things like that. And so he realized immediately that he needed to go further in his studies in order to really be able to minister to the people there. But he had to do it secretly because his presence in China was constantly under the scrutiny of the East India Company. Again, we saw this issue with William Carey as well. A lot of the early missionaries faced opposition from the commerce and the trading entity that was the East India Company. They were just kind of had their hand in everything, and they wanted to make sure everything in the empire just, stayed status quo. Let's not stir things up here. You know, you missionaries coming in trying to, improve things and help the people. You might cause an insurrection and cause problems. So they just wanted everything to kind of stay pat. But
the East India Company, was that a British thing?
Yeah, that's they controlled a lot of the trade and commerce for Britain for the whole East.
Okay.
So, I mean, they were a really big, I don't know what you would call them, just business conglomerate? I don't know what that would be. So, I mean, they were just, very, very powerful.
Okay.
And remember, because Britain, during this time, during the 1800s, this is when Britain ruled the world, the British Empire that ruled the seas. And so a good part of that came about because of their trade and things like that. And so the East India Company had a lot of power. They're very lucrative. And they were, they had their hand very much in the colonization process and everything because they were, they were the economy. They represented the economics of the whole thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So, where am I? Okay, so, he was under this, under the watchful eye of the East India Company, but he kind of had to do things secretly as far as learning the language and stuff, but as time went on, he was able to get some language tutors. He began compiling a dictionary and secretly translating the Bible. So that's a page from the dictionary that he ended up making, an English-Chinese dictionary. And like I said, his main goal was to translate the Bible, but, the dictionary also would come in handy. So the Lord actually used his work on the dictionary to make a favorable impression with the East India Company. They're like, oh, maybe this guy isn't all bad. If he can do a dictionary for us, that would be super helpful. And so they actually gave him a position as a translator. And so it's kind of cool how the Lord opened doors for him through that. Remember Henry Martin, right, was an employee of the East India Company, and that was it gave him favor and allowed some open doors that some of the other missionaries didn't have. And so God really used that for Robert. And he was able to use his new position in the company as protection for future missionary and ministry endeavors. And so around this time, Morrison got married to a gal named Mary Morton. I feel like every missionary's wife's name during that time was Mary. Kind of weird. But anyway, their marriage was very difficult because he was forced to spend a lot of time away from his wife and kids. After 6 years, she went home to England with their two kids, only made one more brief visit 6 years later, and then she just died suddenly in 1821. So it's like, gosh, it was a real sad, hard thing. And so, the family cares really weighed on Morrison, as well as the fact that he, sometimes needed to still be very on the DL with his ministry, with the ministry side of what he was doing. He kind of had to mind his P's and Q's around the East India Company, even though he had favor with them. It was always kind of a precarious situation. So in spite of this, in spite of the burdens and things, he persevered. He finally completed the Chinese Bible in 1824 and then headed to England for his first furlough in 17 years, which was a really important time because this was when he began to start telling other people in the churches back home about ministry in China and about the great needs there. I mean, this is the first guy to go and do it, so he could tell them firsthand what it was like, the fact that they needed more people to come over, or that he needed more people to come over. And so he was able to do a lot of recruiting and stir up interest for missions in China. And so in 1826, 2 years later, he went back to continue translation work and evangelism. He had remarried at this point, and they ended up having several more kids. He also brought with him some recruits. And his health broke, sadly, soon after this. He ended up dying in 1834, but not before leaving his mark on missions to China. Even though Morrison only had about 10 converts during 27 years of ministry, which we can't even really fathom. I mean, that's like your whole lifetime, right? You only see 10 people come to Christ, and you're supposed to be a missionary, you know, bringing in the masses. I mean, we don't see that as like, wow, this amazing fruit, but God used him, like so many of these others, to pave the way for a huge work that he would do in the next generation. And so, again, and I think I might have mentioned this last week, these early missionaries remind me so much of Hebrews 11 when it says that these all died in faith, not having received the promises, right? When it says that, that's how a lot of these guys were, you know? They basically lived their lives totally in faith that God was going to do a work, whether they got to see it or not. And sometimes they did. William Carey got to see fruit in his ministry, for sure. Mary Slessor probably did to some degree. You know, there were those that saw some, but some of them, like Morrison, didn't really get to see a lot. But if he could have seen what God did in the next generation after him, it would have blown his mind. And, of course, he did from heaven, so I'm sure he was stoked. Morrison had once prayed, quote, that God would station him in that part of the field where the difficulties are the greatest and to all human appearance the most insurmountable. Can you imagine actually praying that and meaning it? Lord, station me where the difficulties are the greatest and the and to human appearance the most insurmountable.
That's China. Look at the writer. I mean,
yeah, exactly. But that's what, that was his heart. But just think about it. Like, yes, yes, thanks for that. Ruining a spiritual moment.
I know these last week.
I know, man. I'm like trying to make an important point here. So, it's okay. But the point is, think about that kind of a heart and mentality. You know, how many of us could honestly say that? Lord, send me into something that looks humanly impossible. Because I know that what is impossible to man is possible with God. And that you can do greater things than I can even see through this situation. And so that was, yes, thank you. All right. I'm daunted by Michael's comment. I'm just kidding. Don't worry about it. I know, it is. It's a Northern language. It is. This was a huge challenge, but I just love these guys and their hearts and their passion, of course, for, you know, the furthering the gospel, but for the Lord, and just the fact that, Lord, I want to honor you. Whatever that looks like, it doesn't really matter. I know, I think they understood, like, your life is a success if you do what God calls you to do, regardless of what it looks like, regardless of the circumstances, you know, just be available and trust that God is going to use it, because he always is faithful to do that, and he did. He used this man's life. He willingly embraced the hardest work to the most, you know, hard-hearted people. You know, Mary Slessor did the same, David Livingston did the same. They all did the same thing. They just embraced that because they knew the love of God for those people, and the love of God that would come down, you know, and dwell among us. It's like, well, gosh, if Jesus Christ is willing to come down and do this, you know, and come to earth and die for me, then how can I not go out and do the same and live completely for him and be willing to give my life wherever he calls me? So just having that, you know, gospel-centered proper perspective, I think, is so cool. So that's Morrison. Then we have, of course, the fruit of his ministry was this guy, J. Hudson Taylor, who went in the generation after him. And so, again, Morrison didn't live to see it, but what God did through this guy in the following generation brought in so much fruit. And I think, you know, when we get to heaven, we'll see that some of that, you know, the Lord honored Robert Morrison's hard years of labor through the life of this guy. And so it's kind of neat. You know, like, I don't know, whatever. But not in heaven like you even care anymore, but I just think it's kind of neat. You know, you see the rewards that probably went to Robert Morrison on his account. So, this is Hudson Taylor's probably Livingston's rival for most famous missionary title. He's pretty much legendary in the history of missions because of his amazing evangelization work through the founding of the China Inland Mission, which is over there. Hudson Taylor's whole story is one of the most beautiful pictures of faith that you could read about, and so I wish I had time to tell you guys the details, but I really, since I don't, I really encourage you guys, even if you don't read a million missionary biographies like I think you should, read Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret. You will not be disappointed. That's if you haven't read it before. It used to be required reading for the Bible College back in the day as part of like the missions class and stuff like that. Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret.
It's required for fourth semester PCM class.
Oh, it is? Oh, sweet. Okay. So they do have to read it.
PCM.
Practical
Christian Ministry.
Yeah. Pac-Man?
Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret.
Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret, yeah. Actually, there's another one he wrote himself, and it's all in his own words. It's called A Retrospect. It's like his early life and ministry, and that's, I love that one. That's my favorite one, but, you know. The Spiritual Secret is one that's really common. It's been reprinted and published a million times, so easy to find. So I encourage you guys to read it. I have to just hit some of the high points. I can't get into a lot of the details. But anyway, so Taylor was saved as a teenager through the prayers of his godly mother. And that story in and of itself is just pretty remarkable. But you'll have to read about it yourself soon after he surrendered his life to the Lord. And unbeknownst to him at the time, his parents had always prayed that they would have a son who could serve the Lord in China. Talk about a specific prayer. They had prayed that before he was even born. And so amazing how the Lord eventually answered those prayers, you know, through their son. I mean, I'm sure they were just as floored as he was. And when they told him that, they didn't tell him until he was getting on the ship to go to China. Like, hey, by the way, we prayed for this before you were born. So I think that was just, like, amazing how the Lord honored those prayers. So once he set his sights on China, he began to study medicine. He used his time in practical preparation, of course, but also in spiritual preparation, and he decided to toughen himself up a little bit. He cut back on food and material possessions. He got rid of a bunch of his stuff, you know, from his down mattress to his library and his books. He just tried to, streamline and trim down as much as possible before he even went on the mission field, because he wanted to be as prepared as possible for a life of simplicity, even a life of hardship. And, you know, as much as he could, he wanted to be ready and have that right mindset, like I said, in practical ways. But then there was also the spiritual side. He decided that he wanted to pray for the Lord to meet all of his needs without actually making those needs known to people. And so he just basically trusted God to provide without asking for money, as he said, moving man through God by prayer alone. That was kind of, in his own words, how he viewed it. I'm going to move man through God by prayer alone. That later became a trademark of the China Inland Mission. And it kind of made the CIM the father of the faith missions. Because the faith missions was like this whole group of missionary societies that sprung up in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And the China Inland Mission was the one that really inspired all of these. Missions, these missions that were established, like I said, in faith, not, you know, asking for finances, but allowing the Lord to provide just through prayer. And so Hudson, and there's so many stories, like I said, it's cool, because some of those I think are in the book. Some of them I think are in the Retrospect book, which I also recommend, the one that he wrote called The Retrospect, because that's where he gets into a lot more of the details of how he would pray for things, and then the Lord would, like, you know, bless him with stuff. It was just, you know, financially come through at the last minute. Really cool things. So Hudson finally headed for China in 1853. He arrived in Shanghai, and on his arrival, he found himself totally alone. He was supposed to connect with some missionaries there on the coast in Shanghai, but the people that he was originally told to go and connect with had either died or moved away. I mean, that's like, you know, this is 1800s. It's not like they could find out, like, overnight, somebody just send an email, hey, so-and-so, pray for us, we're not doing well, we might have to leave the mission station. I mean, they had no warning. People just would be gone. People died without people finding out for months. So he's alone there. Also, he came right in the middle of kind of a period of civil unrest, and there was a lot of, like, danger of war. There's a real touch-and-go situation in Shanghai politically, and so there were, like, you know, gunfire going off and bombs and things. One of his friends actually had, one time was, like, sitting in the living room of his apartment having his tea, because it was a British friend, of course, so he's having his tea. He goes into the kitchen to heat up the kettle to make some more tea, and while he's in the kitchen, he hears this crash, and he comes back running into the living room and sees, like, a cannonball had landed on the table that he'd just been sitting at, like, a few moments before. So it's, like, It's like these near-death experiences. That sort of thing happened to Hudson all the time. It was just like, oh my gosh, what is going on here? And so, you know, he's dealing with that. He's dealing with loneliness and just wondering, what am I doing here? And then he finally met up with some of the people that were currently missionaries there already in China. He was totally disillusioned by what he saw in them. He just, like Mary Slessor and Livingston and some others, what he saw was complacency and, you know, just no desire to further the gospel inland or to press on to other fields. It was all about, like, let's just keep in our little community here. This is safe and secure and nice, and we'll just do our thing. And so he was super discouraged by all of this. In fact, he felt that the missionaries there were worldly and just had no vision. And so he desired to press into the interior of China, which should sound familiar because that's what all of these great, you know, pioneers and foundation layers, that's what they all did. They all had that heart and that passion from the Lord to go where the gospel hadn't been proclaimed yet. And so he started wanting to go out into the interior, and then he discovered that he needed to connect with the people better than he was. He needed to have, he needed to be more like them, more, you know, more one of them. He needed a greater affinity with the people, and so he began to wear Chinese clothes. He grew out a little pigtail, because that's what the Chinese men wore back then. So it was like, you know, a more dainty little mullet kind of a thing. So he's like, I need to look like them, because he was such a distraction in his Western clothing. He's walking around in his little suit and tie and his, you know, hat and everything, and he was super distracting to the Chinese people. And he's like, I need to just be able to freely move among them so that they can hear my message and not just be looking at my clothes or looking at my appearance, you know. I don't want them to be distracted. I want them to hear the gospel. And so other missionaries mocked and criticized Hudson for doing this, but he knew he needed to identify with the people to be most effective. And this became another great trademark of the China Inland Mission in later years, becoming all things to all men, but in a proper understanding of the concept. Remember some of the Jesuit missionaries that had gone out before, right, that said they were becoming all things to all men by, you know, becoming like the Buddhist monks or like the Confucian scholars. The problem with that was they were identifying with other religions, right, and that's confusing. That sends a very confused message. Hudson Taylor just adapted to the culture around him, like the clothing and stuff like that. He wasn't trying to, you know, identify with religions, just with the people in general, with the peasants. And so that, I think, was the right understanding of that concept. And so, you know, because of that, he became a very effective evangelist in these early years because of his passion to reach unreached inland China. And so in 1857, he officially resigned from the Chinese Evangelization Society, the group that originally sent him out. He also married this gal named Maria. So not Mary, but Maria, you know. He upgraded there. Anyway. That's not an upgrade. That's just a different name. Anyway. But, anyways, and there's, like, this whole story about the gal who was sort of her guardian there didn't like Hudson Taylor because he was such a radical and weird, you know, he's dressed like a Chinese person and stuff. And she had been one of Robert Morris. This old lady, her name is Mary Aldersey. She'd been one of Robert Morrison's original recruits. And so she was a cool, you know, she was like the first woman missionary to China, but she was a little set in her ways, and she didn't like Hudson Taylor and tried to break up their relationship, but, you know, the Lord totally overrode her, and they ended up getting married anyways. It's a long story. It's kind of a cool story, but we don't have time for it. So anyway, so together, Maria and Hudson ministered in Ningpo for the next few years. They worked at the hospital there and, you know, started a little Chinese church and saw it grow. But in 1861, Hudson's health was failing, and so they had to go back home to England. And during that time, the Lord really began to burden Hudson's heart to stir up the call to foreign missions back in England. And so he wrote, you know, he'd preach and he'd write to newspapers and magazines and things like that. He wrote this in one periodical. He said, "Can all Christians in England sit still with folded arms while multitudes in China are perishing for lack of knowledge? For lack of knowledge which England possesses so richly." So he's very straight up. He's like, can you guys all just sit here while there's people dying without hearing the gospel? Let's, you know, try to light a fire under everyone. Let's go. And so he began to realize that in order to do what the Lord was putting on his heart to do, there needed to be a new missions organization established, something to evangelize the interior, not just the coastal regions. And so he had a plan to recruit 24 people, two for each of China's provinces. At the time, there were 12 provinces in China, so he wanted to send two to each one just to start out. One missions historian said it was a visionary plan that would have left veteran recruiters breathless. It would increase the number of Chinese missionaries by 25%. And so, I mean, that's like a major step, you know, for missions, Chinese missions in that day. This was just like radical. And he himself really struggled with this. Like the vision that he had, he really struggled with that. Like, God, I mean, I have such a heart for this, but how in the world is this going to happen? How am I going to get a bunch of Europeans to come with me over to China and you know, live in a totally different way than what they're accustomed to? Because he felt the Lord was calling him not just to go into interior China, but to live by faith. You know, we're going to live by faith and just pray for God to provide our finances. We're not going to be, you know, constantly appealing to people and asking for money or anything like that. We're going to just pray and let the Lord meet our needs. He also wanted these missionary recruits to do what he did and dress like Chinese people. And he knew that would be pretty radical for, you know, these proper English people coming over. Again, who were used to, you know, because usually when Westerners went to Asia, Africa, Europe, or wherever they were, Asia, Africa, South America, wherever they were going, they would stay British, right? That's just what they did. They would just stay their way. And so for him to say, like, we're all going to dress Chinese, that was just, like, scandalous. Like, we don't do that. We're Western civilized people. We can't do that. And so he knew this was a big deal, and he didn't know if they were going to be able to handle it. And so he's like, gosh, Lord, really? Are you sure about this? God finally brought him to a place of surrender in 1865, and he said, there the Lord conquered my own belief, and I surrendered myself to God for this service. I told him that all responsibility as to the issues and consequences must rest with him, that as his servant, it was mine to obey and follow him. And thus was born the China England Mission. And that is a key, you know, really it is a key moment, you know, not only in missions history, but I think in church history in general. And soon the Lord provided many recruits. They all headed back to China. There was a lot of drama and division at first between the missionaries. And here they are. This was the first group, the Lammermuir Party. And again, I don't have time to get into the story, but one of the guys in this group caused all kinds of division and problems. But eventually, like, the Lord, like, totally overrode and dealt with it through a number of circumstances. And they began to get established. The Lord began to grow and prosper the ministry. And it was neat. Hudson Taylor encouraged all kinds of people, even single women, to minister in the interior. In fact, most of these gals in here are single women. Which was kind of unheard of back then, because this is still early in the missions era, and so people are thinking, well, if a woman's going to go at all, she could probably be married, and, you know, or she's protected. You know, people like Mary Slessor were like, whoa, crazy, you know? Like, again, that was very unconventional, what she did, and radical. But he said, doesn't matter, man. If you have a heart for the gospel, you know Jesus, then you have something to share, you know, and God can use you. And so he had great faith in that way, to just empower people to just go. And so, quote, between his work ethic and his absolute trust in God, he inspired thousands to forsake the comforts of the West and bring the Christian message to the vast, unknown interior of China. At one point, he actually had this radical idea that if he could get 1,000 evangelists to share the gospel with 250 people each day, all of inland China would have heard the gospel in 3 years. Now, that's super...
Wait, 1,000 evangelists to share the gospel with 250 people every day?
Yeah, each. And then in 3 years, all of China would have heard the gospel. Remember, China's like, what, the most populated country in the world.
Every day you have to preach to 250 people?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, this was super radical, very far-fetched. But, you know, even though this was, like, impossible, because, like, what if you get sick one day and it's like, oh, I have to do 500 people tomorrow, I'm not going to be able to, you know. I mean, physically, it's not really humanly possible. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, God could do this, something like that. But, you know, even though it was far-fetched, he had such vision. You know, he had such vision. And I think that's what the Lord really honored and blessed. I mean, he really, you know, I know it's like a cheesy term, but I think he really had a divine wind behind him. You know, he honored the Lord and just had such passion and vision for the Lord. I mean, he'd wake up in the middle of the night and pray and read his Bible. I mean, he was just so, like, committed to hearing from the Lord and to, you know, doing what God called him to do. And to bring the gospel wherever it was not known, that God honored that, you know? Even though it was kind of crazy, some of his ideas, God honored it. And so by 1882, the China Inland Mission was in every province. By 1895, there were over 640 missionaries serving in China. That's crazy, you guys. It's like, what, just at, you know, what, 70 years after Robert Morrison, 60 years after Robert Morrison, who had only been, like, the, you know, one man? Oh, Robert Morrison died in 1834, and so by, what, 50 years later, 50 to 60 years later, you know, there's 640 missionaries there, you know, so it's just like, it's amazing, you know, it got started with that one guy, and then after him came all of this, and so, here we go, exactly. And there was another guy named Carl Goodsloff, too, which I'm planning to talk about, but he had been one of those early pioneer guys, too, and then Hudson just came in, and the Lord, you know, did a work, and so, obviously, it wasn't easy. There were so many trials and things that I don't have time to get into. At one point, Hudson actually had a physical mental breakdown in 1900. His wife, Maria, died young, and he remarried to that other girl in the picture, that one on the right. He remarried her. That's Jenny. She'd been one of the original, in this picture, Jenny's right there. Look at her, like, kind of waving the wings for Maria to die. I'm sorry. No, not at all. I'm just kidding. But it's, you know, okay, anyways. So, there were tragedies in Hudson's life. Four of their eight children died, you know, so there were some real hard things, but, you know, the Lord just moved in a real mighty way. By 1914, when World War I started, the China Inland Mission had become the largest foreign mission organization in the world, and it continues on to this day. Does anyone know what the China Inland Mission became? Ooh, super obscure question. Do you remember this from class, Sean?
Wait for it. I have it written down.
Oh, he has it somewhere. He took missionary bio, so he knows. He could have gotten up here and taught this one, this class. All right, Overseas Missions Fellowship. Has anyone heard of that? Missionary Fellowship? OMF? Okay, OMF is a really well-established organization. They've been doing, you know, missionary work for years. They publish a lot of missionary stories and stuff. Anyone heard of Isabel Kuhn? She's really, oh, she's awesome. She's a really awesome author who's written a lot of books about her own missionary life in China and, you know, some other, or sorry, not in, yes, in China, sorry. And then some other people there. Anyway, so OMF continues on to this day, which is always kind of neat when you can see the fruit that continues on into the following generation. So God took one sold out and committed man, and he did a real mighty work. In Hudson's own words, he said, China is not to be won for Christ by quiet, ease-loving men and women. The stamp of men and women we need is such as will put Jesus, China, and souls first and foremost in everything at every time. Even life itself must be secondary. Which is, wow. It's quite a statement, but this is coming from a guy who kind of lived it out, you know? I mean, he was pretty radical. But the Lord honors that. And so, with that, we've covered some of the great pioneers of the missionary era. Again, really, even though I covered a lot of the great names, I mean, that's just scratching the surface. There's so many other people. We don't have time for it. You'll just have to take missionary bios with me next semester. But like I said, that's a very general title for this time period, the missionary era. Missions and outreach, as we've already discussed, were probably the greatest and the most dynamic trademark of the church of the 1800s. But along with that was a lot of amazing fruit on the home front during this time. And so that's what we're going to move into for the rest of this class today. We're going to now transition into what was going on the home front during the 1800s. Because while missions was wonderful, there was a lot of great stuff happening at home as well. Now, remember in that quote from your book, I'm going to just do the intro to all of this and then we'll take a break. I read this quote, I think, last week or the week before. At this time, there was, quote, an aggressive concern for Christian service in the world. And that extended not just to the mission field, but to every area of society. And we saw that a lot of this was the fruit of all of those revivals. And that, you know, the Great Awakening, the Pietism, Methodist Revival, all of that had sparked this concern in society. And so European and American society, while you know, obviously missions went out across the world, European and American society also was ripe for a movement towards service and ministry, because there was so much happening on the home front at this time. As you read in your book, at the end of the 1700s, the early 1800s, witnessed unprecedented amounts of change in society. That's why Shelley calls this era the Age of Progress. He calls it the Age of Progress because there was so much change, so much technology, so much advancement on so many different levels. And so in that, I want to highlight four major issues, four major things that I see. I guess you could call them issues/events. First of all, we have the French Revolution. Right, of 1789. And I put those up on the board as well. Four major things here. The French Revolution, and this was huge. This was, of course, when the common people, the proletariat, took over the nation. They overthrew the monarchy. And this was a cataclysmic break with the old world order, the way things had always been, right? Where the monarchy and the aristocracy rule everyone, and then you just have the peasants underneath them that are just basically under their thumb and not ever able to improve or advance themselves. And so, you know, you've got everything in the hands, you know, so much in the hands of the of so few people. And then all the common people. So again, it was just very, that was the way things had been for centuries, and now all of a sudden the common people rose up and overthrew the monarchy. And this sent shockwaves all over Europe. And remember, the French Revolution wasn't all good. I mean, yeah, there were some things about this that were probably good in terms of causing all the other countries in Europe to mind their P's and Q's. Everybody saw what happened in France, and they were like, whoa, we better get our, you know, get our act together here. No more crazy spending. No more, you know, just living lavish lifestyles here and exploiting common people. We need to kind of be careful because they might rise up against us like they did over in France, right? So that was good because it caused the upper classes to show a little more concern for what was going on in the lower classes and to kind of cut back a little bit and not, you know, get too carried away, like I said, with lavish lifestyles and luxury and things that would make the common people unsettled and cause unrest socially. And so there were some good things with all of that, but there were a lot of bad things that happened as a result of the French Revolution. Interestingly, the French were inspired by the American Revolution, which had happened just, you know, a decade earlier. But because the French leaders did not have the same biblical guidelines as a lot of the American revolutionaries did, they went in a totally different direction. And so the French Revolution was very violent. To some extent, it was anti-Christian. And that explains a lot of France's issues to this day. They did a lot to eradicate, you know, the Christian faith and their Christian heritage from their society at that time in favor of reason, right? Because remember what else came out of France during that same time? We talked about this a couple weeks ago.
Right.
And what?
Fries.
Fries came out during that time. That was really revolutionary. Yep. French toast also. What?
Oh, I didn't
know. The Enlightenment. Thank you, Rod. Somebody's serious in this class. All right. The Enlightenment was all about glorifying what? God?
No.
Man, human reason, right? And the Enlightenment and the French Revolution went hand in hand with each other. They inspired one another, and so it was all about man and man's reason. Therefore, we're going to get rid of God as much as we can. And so, like I said, they were inspired by the American Revolution, but they didn't follow those same guidelines with those biblical principles and things. And so it led to all kinds of chaos and bad stuff. You got this going on, Madame Guillotine, the guillotine. There's chopping people's heads off everywhere.
Very pompous.
It got out of control. And so the revolution precipitated, obviously, the overthrow of the king. But also, another overthrow happened in European society during, you know, a century later. And it was all kind of like repercussions from the French Revolution. The fall of the Pope in 1870, which you guys read about. And this was when a movement for Italian unity led to the demise of the Papal States, which ended Rome's political power once and for all. So the Pope, you know, not only does the French monarchy get the boot, but the Pope lost a lot of his power and political clout as a result of all of this. And so, you know, and this was, you know, really, this was the end of Rome's political power once and for all. I mean, it was kind of the end as far as that was concerned. You know, there was no chance of the church rising up and taking over Europe again like they had in the Middle Ages. That wasn't going to happen. But at the same time, the Catholic Church felt the need to reiterate their position in light of all of these changes going on in society. I mean, things were kind of uncontrollably changing, and so they needed to find a way to adjust and deal with what was happening in the world around them. And yet, instead of trying to go with the flow of modernization and progress, once again, the Catholic Church retreated into itself and went back into its age-old stance, just as it had done during the Reformation, right? Do you remember what church council happened during the Reformation? Trent. Dang, very good. The Council of Trent, right, was the time when the Catholic Church, instead of going with what was going on or you know, searching their heart to see if maybe it was time for a change, they said, no, we're going to just go back to doing what we've always done since the Middle Ages. We're going to go back to what Thomas Aquinas said, and we're going to use his theology. and forget the reformers and blah, blah, blah. So they kind of did the same thing here a couple hundred years later. The church refused to back down on their traditional doctrines and viewpoints and just forcefully restated them again, just like the church had done during the Reformation at the Council of Trent. They did the same thing here. And so in 1870, with the fall of the Pope, the fall of the Pope also marks the ruling of the First Vatican Council in support of the primacy and infallibility of the Pope, which is held to this day. So again, they just forcefully restated their age-old stance, the same opinions that they'd always had. So that was in, again, 1870, First Vatican Council in the fall of the Pope. But it wasn't just political, religious upheaval going on. These were big deals, of course. The French Revolution, all of this stuff was huge. But there was also massive change in society in the areas of science and technology that would forever change the Western world, basically. You know, society, economy, everything. And, of course, that was represented by the Industrial Revolution. This is the picture of, you know, social and technological advancement and change.
Smog.
Smog. This is when smog came out. Yep. The development of textile mills, factories, especially with the discovery of steam power and all that stuff. It revolutionized the face of Europe as many common people, you know, just the normal common folks living an agrarian life out in the fields, working in, you know, on their farms and stuff like that. They all began to abandon the rural agrarian life and move into towns and cities to work in the factories and in the mills, because this is where there were a lot of jobs and possibilities of advancement. And I think a lot of people probably came with romanticized views that I'm going to have a whole new life. I'm going to move into where the factories are. I'm going to work there and live in the big city and all this sort of a thing. And so urban populations, what?
Work 80 hours.
Yeah, what a life, you know? But again, they probably didn't know what they were getting into. You know, you're coming out, you're kind of naive little farm kids coming in to work in the factories and stuff. You know, I mean, and there were other reasons for these kind of changes as well. And so, just, you know, again, the whole social picture, like, kind of just, the map changed, you know, in terms of, like, just the growth of cities and some of the farmland being taken up and, you know, taken away by housing projects and, you know, all of this other stuff. And so urban populations began to grow tremendously. And, of course, with that, whenever you have a bunch of people moving into a more concentrated area, you're going to have a lot more people problems than you do in a more agrarian community, right, where there's, like, lots of space and farms and land and, you know, your nearest neighbor's 4 miles away. If your nearest neighbor is, like, 4 feet away, it's going to create some different dynamics in your life. And so that's what happened here. A lot of people problems emerged that had not been as great of an issue as they were now. And so you have things like overcrowding and I'll get into that in a second. Sanitation, crime, homelessness, illiteracy, poverty, prostitution, just to name some of the major issues that, you know, society was suddenly faced with. Like, oh my gosh, how are we going to deal with all of these things, you know? And it wasn't necessarily that anyone planned for all of this to happen either. That's why it's called the Industrial Revolution. You know, a revolution is a sudden overthrow or a sudden event, right? And it suddenly kind of just changed everything, and people were, you know, in a way, weren't equipped or prepared to know where it would lead or what was going, you know, how they were going to handle it. And so you have all of this going on with the Industrial Revolution. And, here's some pictures of that. Well, I was going to show that one later, but that's okay. So this is some of what happened with industrialization. You have, like kids like Mary Slessor and David Livingston working in the, look at that. There is no way on earth that you would see little kids working in heavy machinery today. If somebody took a picture of that and posted it, like, in a, you know, online or something, they would shut them down so fast. So, I mean, look at that lady under that huge wheel. I mean, this is just crazy, the stuff that was going on.
What are they doing there?
I'm not sure. These little kids were called piecers. They'd have to go into the machinery when the machines would get stuck and go and try to pull the fabric out. Kids would lose arms. Kids would die. I mean, so many things happened. It was a pretty rough scene, to say the least.
Yeah, it looks like
styles. Yeah, just textiles and stuff. This is, like, probably cotton, like, making spinning cotton, you know, fabric, thread, stuff like that. And there's another, and this is another picture of just the overcrowding. I mean, this is, you know, over London by, it is 1870, right in the middle of all of that. You know, you've got people just, I mean, who knows how many families are living in each of those buildings. Like just tenement housing all smashed together. So you've got a lot of social issues that resulted from industrialization. So this was a major thing, all right? The Industrial Revolution was another major issue, another major aspect of change in society. And then, of course, there is the whole slave issue, right? The slave issue. In the late 1700s and the early 1800s, the public conscience in America and Europe began to be pricked by the issue of slavery. And the practice of capturing slaves had been an accepted institution in America since, 1619, when the colonies were first forming. You know, that's when slavery technically began, was that year, long, long time ago. And yet it had grown so much in the following centuries that, you know, it had become kind of an issue, a problem, you know, a moral issue, and it couldn't be ignored anymore. I mean, look at this. This is a diagram. You guys might have seen this before, right? It's kind of famous depiction of a slave ship. And so they would just diagram out, like, here's how many slaves we can fit down in the hole in the bottom of the boat here. And so these are all of these little lines represent people. Yeah. And so they would just kind of map it out, like, okay, we can smash this many. I mean, they just were treated as, like, yeah, not even cattle, but just, like, as a product, as merchandise. Okay, it's like, how many boxes and crates can we fit into this space? That's how they were viewing human lives. You know, we're just going to squish as many of these people as we can into this space. A bunch of them are going to die on the way over, so we have to make sure we can get a lot of people in there so that it makes up for how many die. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was like 40% of slaves would die.
Yeah, but they figure, well, that's why we have to, yeah, pack as many in as possible, because the 60% that live, at least we'll have a good return on our investment. It's like terrible the way they viewed it. So, again, this had become a moral issue by now. You know, maybe initially it was just like, okay, we just need, you know, labor and help working on the farms and plantations and stuff, but it had become a major issue. And so Europe began to speak out against slavery pretty early on, thanks to guys like William Wilberforce and David Livingston. We'll talk about Wilberforce in, after the break. They really led the charge in exposing the evils of the slave trade to the West. But it was a little bit harder to root out of America because it was part of our society here, and especially our economy since the earliest days. You know, that wasn't the case in Europe necessarily. But in America, I mean, it was like we kind of built so many things on slave labor from the early days. And so even in the church, there was division over the issue. And for us, you know, today we find it very hard to justify the enslavement of human beings, especially in that kind of a manner. But back then, there were pastors who would quote scripture to, you know, support their pro-slavery stance and had no problem with that. So really crazy stuff. And so in the end, even though I have to say state rights was probably the biggest issue involved, slavery became a major point of contention in the Civil War, okay, the American Civil War, 1860 to 1865. Again, like I said, if you, you know, really study all the history of it, the state right thing was the biggest issue, but slavery really came to the forefront. It became a major moral issue in the Civil War that many Christians began to speak out about. And so you've got all of these major upheavals in European and American society, you know, French Revolution, fall of the Pope, Industrial Revolution, Civil War. But the cool thing is that this brought unprecedented opportunity for ministry, for service. In particular, you know, even though, yeah, the French Revolution, the fall of the Pope, the First Vatican, those were more counted, those were more like historic political events more than anything, but the Industrial Revolution and even the Civil War really represent social trends and issues. You know, you're dealing with urbanization, slavery, I mean, these are major social issues. And so there were lots of needs, lots of problems that arose during this time that needed to be addressed, and God really raised up his people to meet a lot of those needs. People that knew the power of the gospel, the power of God, the power of his word to make a radical difference in society. And that's exactly what happened. In fact, I have a topical history book in my office, and I was amazed when you look in the section on activists, in the good sense of the term, people that were active in society. You know, nowadays, activists are people that go and blow them, you know, blow up abortion clinics and stuff. But back then, it was just people that, you know, were active in society, and it was amazing how most of them were from the 1700s and 1800s. I mean, this was a real, a time when, you know, God's people really got mobilized in society. I could teach a whole class on Christians of the 1800s. In fact, I really want to try to develop that at some point, if I ever have time. So, society was definitely in need during that time, and so essentially what the missionaries accomplished on the foreign field, these guys accomplished on the home front, the activists in society. And it's interesting because a lot of these are not just important figures in church history, but in all of history as well, to show that what they did, which shows, I think, that what they did affected everything around them. It wasn't just a church thing. It was like, man, what they did really affected all of society. And so just as we saw missionaries turn foreign nations upside down, we're going to also see some key figures that turned British and American society upside down with the gospel as well. So let's take a break. Way late, I'm so sorry. But I wanted to kind of try to get all that out of the way before we move into the next things. I always forget to push stop or record. Record, right?
Record, yeah.
Okay. I don't know why I can never get that right. That is Craig. What the heck? Nobody tells me anything around here. Sorry, Joel's here.
Well, now the office is empty too.
Joel went home? What?
He always goes home.
Yeah, he goes home early.
You know what? Yeah, you guys are gonna, yeah. Like I said, you always receive great reward in heaven for being here tonight.
I had a question about Joel and Dave Shirley's book, The Drama Redemption.
Yeah.
Did they print that?
Yeah.
Did they actually print copies of it? Do they always have copies of it?
They should, yeah, it's a book, yeah, they've got it.
Because I've had a PDF for a long time, and I always wanted a hard copy.
Yeah, no, they have it, for sure.
No, I've got it, yeah.
Ask at the office. I mean, there's probably one in his office next door somewhere. Who's going to steal it? No, I'm just kidding. As I say that on recording.
So if it disappears, you're in trouble.
Is that a chapel store?
What?
Is that a chapel store?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know if they have it there. But I know you could definitely, I can get you a copy, or if you ask the office, they might have one here. If they don't, let me know and I'll get you one.
Okay, I'll let you know right now because I don't know how to crack. I mean, I can call them, but we always come late. And
yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, just call during the day, and if they don't have it, email or let me know and I'll.
Okay.
I'll see what I can do. So, okay. Yeah. Yes. Fun fact, my sister is in. He put my sister in the acknowledgments for that because she helped him write all his original notes for that.
It's a good book. So I've actually highlighted a lot of that book.
Yeah, no, I love the history of redemption class. That's good stuff. So, all right, let's do this. All right, we're going to talk about. Oh wait, whoops! Here's another Civil War battlefield picture.
My cousin.
That's him, huh?
Yeah, that's him.
There he is, taking a nap. Anyways,
just got their jeans.
More going on.
Wait, how?
The dude on the horse.
Oh my gosh. Anyways,
where are we from?
Who are you?
Yeah, this is jacked up. I'm sorry I even went there.
I was talking about the top picture. You guys are talking about the bottom picture.
Your cousin is in that top picture.
Oh, the top one. Okay.
Are you really that old, Michael? Is that what you're saying? You mean a long cousin way back?
Yeah, a distant cousin.
Distant cousin.
Wait, wait.
All right!
We are wrong.
I know.
That's
unfinished. Okay, yes. William Wilberforce, the original member of the Jackson 5. I've never had anyone say that was an afro. They usually just know that that's just shading in the background. But anyways.
That was probably one of your better jokes right there.
Thank you.
I appreciated that.
Oh, good, yeah. You said it must have been pretty bad, huh? Okay.
No, that was just a good one.
I love the Jackson 5.
I do, too. ABC. Okay, so... let's talk about some key figures in the anti-slavery movement first, and then we'll talk about key figures that dealt with urbanization and the Industrial Revolution and all those effects. So, first of all, the slave issue. This guy is one of my all-time favorite guys. I love William Wilberforce. So,
he looks stressed.
He had a lot of reasons to be stressed out.
He's only 29 and he's got gray hair already. That's
Wow. So, a lot of people go gray hair, right?
Gray hair than bald hair.
Bald hair?
Yeah.
Is that even
bald,
that's
kind of that, right here.
Isn't that a contradiction in terms, bald hair? All right.
Great bald head.
Now, okay, so Wilberforce was a huge force in the anti-slavery movement. He had a powerful voice in the British Parliament. That's why he was such a key figure. So Wilberforce was born into wealth, born into a prestigious family in England. When he was 9, he was sent to go and live with his aunt and uncle, who were good friends of George Whitefield, so very godly couple. So he spent some time with them and was, you know, I think this is where the first seeds of the gospel were planted in his life. But His mom didn't like that he was that he might possibly become too religious. Oh, I don't want you to become a fanatic like those Whitfield people. And so she took him back and encouraged him to be more worldly, which, you know, okay, like what, usually that happens. You know, if you're going to encourage your kids to be worldly, then there's a chance that they will, because that goes with their human nature. So William went on to Cambridge and gained a seat in Parliament when he was only 21, obviously through political connections. There's no other way that could have happened. And he was very physically, he was very weak and frail, but he had such a charismatic personality and such energy that people were just naturally drawn to him. He was very witty, sarcastic, and, you know, so people liked being around him because he was funny and stuff like that. Later, though, he said, my first years in Parliament, I did nothing to any purpose. My own distinction was my darling object. Like, that's all I cared about was making a name for myself. But that all changed when he read a book that confronted him with the gospel that he had heard before when he'd been with his aunt and uncle as a little kid. And he realized that even if he thought he was okay, he was not a Christian. He didn't really know Jesus. And he became overwhelmed, he said, with a sense of my great sinfulness and having so long neglected the unspeakable mercies of my God and Savior. And so he gave his life to Christ right at that moment, no turning back. Quote, he saw clearly that if a man became a Christian, it should influence everything that he thinks and does. And I love that, that he got it. You know, he really got it. Right away he realized, like, this is not a compartmentalized thing where I go to church on Sundays and, you know, do my duty and then I go off and do whatever I want the rest of the week. Because that was happening a lot in England at that time. There was a lot of Christianity, for sure, but a lot of people that were just going through the motions, and we, you know, we attend the church services, we go and bring food baskets to the poor, and we're nice people. But he realized, like, man, if I, you know, Jesus needs to be in charge of every area of my life. He needs to affect everything that I say and everything that I do, and it all needs to be filtered through the light of the Bible. And so he was so radically transformed that he cut off from, you know, everything that he'd been doing before, all sinful recreation, which back then would have been things like going to the theater, smoking, gambling, stuff like that. He just wanted to cut anything out of his life that was not going to, you know, further the kingdom, basically. He almost left Parliament because he just felt like he didn't want to start walking in sin or compromise like some of his colleagues were doing around him. He thought maybe he wouldn't be able to stand his ground. But he was good friends with this older man, this pastor named John Newton. Has anyone heard of John Newton?
Isaac?
No.
Fig?
Fig! I knew that was coming. John Newton wrote a famous hymn. Anyone know? There's a big hint there. What did he write? Anyone know? Oh, Amazing Grace. Okay, John Newton. Now his story in and of itself is an awesome story. John Newton was a slave ship owner, right? He owned a slave ship. Horrible man, you know, brutalized the slaves. I believe he even raped some of the women. He was just a jerk. And then he gets saved, radically saved and transformed, and he writes a hymn, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. And so this was coming from a man who really saw his wretched state before Christ. And so, I mean, I think that's the reason why that song has been so powerful for so, you know, decades and decades, even a couple centuries now, is because, you know, it came from, you know, came from the heart of a man who'd been changed by Jesus. And so John Newton's this great guy, and by this time he's an old man, by the time Wilberforce comes along, and Wilberforce goes to talk to John Newton, and Newton said to him, "It is hoped and believed that the Lord has raised you up for the good of his church and for the good of the nation." In other words, William, stay the course. I know you want to leave Parliament, but I feel like the Lord has put you there for such a time as this. And so he stayed in Parliament, and God used him. In fact, when William Wilberforce got saved, there were only two other Christians in Parliament, but when he died, there were over 100. Wow. And a lot of that had to do with his influence while he was there in office. And so,
This is in England.
In 1787, he wrote in his diary, "God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners," which is morals. That's a, you know, old term for that. So these became not only his major life goals, but these were the areas that God gave him his greatest influence in. You know, these were the two great objects that God put on his heart, and he just followed them with everything in his being till the end of his life. And again, like Hudson Taylor, he was one of those guys that had like a divine wind behind him in what he did. So William stood on, in terms of manners or morals, he stood on many platforms for morality, for ethics, because he could see that even though everybody was keeping up appearances, and there was the pretense of religiousness, or I guess the pretense of religion and being good people and all that sort of thing, he could see that there was a lot of moral decay, a lot of immorality in English society, and so he wanted to strengthen morals and godliness, and he experienced great success. In fact, John Pollock said, I like this, Wilberforce touched the world when he made goodness fashionable. Because he did. He made it, you know, fashionable to be, you know, truly godly and honoring to the Lord. He was dubbed the prime minister in the cabinet of philanthropists because he supported up to 69 philanthropic organizations in his lifetime. He helped establish groups like the Church Missionary Society, the Society for Bettering the Cause of the Poor, the British and Foreign Bible Society, which is still going today, and the Anti-Slavery Society. And so, of course, fighting slavery is really what William became most known for. Again, those were his two great objects. I want to reform manners and morals in England, and I want to, you know, see the end of the slave trade. And so this was what his, like I said, his great real trademark is. This was a very hard road for him to go down, because to get any laws passed against slavery was just like, it would require monumental effort in that day and age. Quote, the pathway to abolition was blocked by vested interest, parliamentary filibustering, entrenched bigotry, international politics, slave unrest, personal sickness, and political fear. He had so many things against him, so much opposition on all fronts, because again, slavery was a big part of the economy, and you know what, if you make a decision here in England, it's going to affect international politics all over the world. I mean, it was just, and then he had his own personal issues he had to deal with in terms of his health and stuff. I mean, he had so many things that weighed on him, or things that were against him in this fight to end slavery. But just like the Apostle Paul said, you know, none of these things move me. And I just think when I look at William Wilberforce's life, I see that same motto, that same, you know, mentality stamped all over it. In fact, in spite of all of the opposition and, again, his own poor health, including bad eyes, he had ulcerated bowels and a curved spine. I mean, he had things that were, like, very painful and very, very hard to work through. In spite of these things, he was described as a delightful and cheerful Christian. And he even spoke of self-denial as a trifling sacrifice. I love that. I was like, man, Lord, I want to have that kind of mentality, you know? We're just so lazy and weak in our culture, you know, compared to a lot of the things that people just, the mentality they had back then, you know, and just to view self-denial as a trifling sacrifice. This is no big deal. Yeah, I've ulcerated bowels, so what? You know, the joy of the Lord is my strength. I'm going to just push through and let God get victory here. That's how he lived. Again, that's how he was described. People knew he was suffering most of the time. And yet, he let God's joy really, again, strengthen and empower him to do all that he did. And so, from 1789 to 1805, that's what, 16 years? William had, well, I guess I should say 1807, which would be 18 years. He had bill after bill after bill against slavery defeated. Everything got shot down over and over and over again. No matter how amazing his speeches were, no matter how stirring his words were, he just could not get through. Prime Minister William Pitt was a friend of Wilberforce, and he said that Wilberforce had the greatest natural eloquence of all the men I ever knew. He was just, you know, again, so able to communicate in a way that could sway a crowd and get everybody to listen to him. And, I mean, he could just engage everyone's attention completely. But he still had to persevere against so many odds. Again, no matter how eloquent he was, people were like, yeah, but this is my pocketbook. We, you know, the slave issue, that opens up such a can of worms. You know, you make a great point there. But, you know, it was just a really, really difficult task that he was taking on, and so there was he faced a lot of slander, a lot of hatred. In one instance, he spoke for 3.5 hours straight, giving what some people called the most gripping and moving speech that had ever been delivered in Parliament. In another instance, the House actually debated one of his bills, and the debate went till 3 a.m, so he thought, I think we're going to break through finally, you know? People can't make up their mind, maybe they're going to go ahead and be swayed and vote for this bill. However, it was defeated in the end. So, I mean, you got all these close calls and all of these things where you think success is coming and then, oh, it fails again. So lots of heartbreak, lots of disappointment. But he knew this was a marathon. You know, this was not a sprint. It was going to require a lot of perseverance. He even wrote, I daily become more sensible that my work must be affected by constant regular exertions rather than by sudden and violent ones. It's just got to be plodding along and persevering. You know, we got the William Carey of the British government here. You know, I'm going to plod and persevere, be a dog with a bone, and just keep going and going. And so finally, again, 18 years later, William Wilberforce experienced sweet victory in 1807 when royal assent was given to the anti-slave trade bill. And then slavery was completely abolished in the British Empire through the Emancipation Act, July of 1833, which was right before Wilberforce died. So I thought, how cool that the Lord let him see that. You know, before he died, he got to see the end of slavery in the British Empire, which is phenomenal. So he was a major force in what some historians have called one of the turning events in the history of the world. And that's not an exaggeration. You know, the end of the slave trade in the British Empire was, it was cataclysmic. I mean, because we're talking, again, the British Empire had its finger in every continent, every part of the world. The sun never set on the British Empire. And so for a decision like that to be made was, it changed the world. It changed the world, literally. And so John Pollock said, Wilberforce would disclaim the credit, but the essentials of his beliefs and his conscience formed the foundation of the British character for the next two generations at least. He was proof that a man may change his times, though he cannot do it alone. And I love him, I know. And this is, again, this is exactly what we saw in the lives of the missionaries, you know? I mean, they changed their world. They turned their world upside down. And that's what Wilberforce did. And just, you know, let's just have a little picture there. That was in Wilberforce's house, another statue of him at Westminster Abbey. Actually, speaking of missionaries, there's a little side note to all of this. Once the slave trade was being addressed, Wilberforce began to throw his efforts into opening up India to missionaries so that the East India Company would get off their backs and stuff. In fact, he supported William Carey. He contributed financially to his ministry, especially when, I don't know if I told you guys this story, but there was a time, I can't remember what year it was 1810 maybe, that the whole printing house that they were doing all of their, you know, Bible translation printing and everything in, it burned down. Nobody saw what happened, but the whole printing house burned down, the printing presses melted, everything just was destroyed. And Wilberforce was one of the guys who contributed to getting all of that stuff rebuilt. So I thought that was kind of cool. You know, you see the connection between these guys back then. And so in 1813, Wilberforce pushed a bill through stating that it was Britain's duty to promote the interest and happiness of the Indian people by taking such measures as may tend to the introduction of useful knowledge and of religious moral improvement. And so, kind of neat, you know, again, to see how, you know, he was so involved on so many fronts, like whatever he could do for the Lord, whatever he could do for the furtherance of the gospel, whatever he could do for the, you know, betterment of the people around him. I mean, that's just, you know, there's just so much fruit from having that kind of surrendered and persevering life. One biographer said, how did Wilberforce manage to persevere in the face of such sustained hatred and character assassination? He established and sustained a lifetime of daily discipline. He knew the value of the first few hours of the day for Bible study and prayer and mental preparation for the day. He surrendered his reputation to God early on, and did all that he could, and then left the result in God's hands. His faith was resilient because it was not in himself, but in God alone. And I love that. Again, remember, this is the man who changed, you know, really kind of changed the world, you could say. And that's, in some sense, not an exaggeration because of what he did within slavery, you know, in slavery, let alone all of the other areas that he changed British society in. And yet, all of this was because it was God doing the work in and through his life, because of where his foundation was. If he had had faith in himself, confidence in himself and what he could do, he wouldn't have been able to do half of what he did. You know, he wouldn't have been sustained. But I think this is a powerful word concerning daily discipline in our walk with God, because this is the kind of strength that it gives, you know, the kind of fruit that it bears when Jesus Christ is our foundation. And when we have our identity in Christ so completely, like Wilberforce did, you know, he wasn't moved by everybody else's opinions or by difficult circumstances. You know, none of those things moved him because he knew who he was in Christ, and he, you know, had that as his anchor when everything else around him was, you know, topsy-turvy and all over the place. And so that's why he didn't fall, and why he continued on, why he had such a lasting legacy, as we've seen with so many of these people that have a legacy that endures, is because of you know, their foundation in Jesus Christ. And so I just love Wilberforce. Tibbetts, he's the best. And then there's another great guy here, John Woolman. One of the first voices to speak out against slavery in America. He was born into a devout Quaker family in New Jersey, and he came to know the Lord when he was pretty young. When he was 23, he felt like the Lord was revealing things to him about just the nobility of his creation, and especially in terms of mankind, that God had created everyone equal and everybody had value and that sort of a thing. And so, you know, he's learning all these things, the Lord's showing him this stuff. And then, you know, he has this revelation from the Lord tested soon after when his boss asked him to write up a bill of sale for a female slave. And he objected to doing this, but he's like, well, I probably should, you know, honor my boss and just go ahead and do it. So he went ahead and wrote up the bill of sale for the slave, passed it on. And as soon as the transaction was completed, his conscience was so stricken that he refused to ever do that again, even if it meant losing his job. He's like, I can't do this anymore. The Lord's like speaking to me about how, you know, about the value of all mankind, and I can't treat these people like animals and just, you know, conduct transactions in human lives. And so over the next several years, Woolman felt called into ministry, and he actually chose to open a business that wouldn't demand a lot of time so that he could make sure he was serving the Lord as fully as possible. And so it's cool because the Lord began to prosper his business. It began to do really well. And so he actually started telling his customers to go to his competitors because he didn't want to start getting too materialistic and too worried about how much money he was making. He's like, no, I'm going to just close down. You go over to them. Go buy something from them. It was like, okay. But, I mean, that's just how concerned he was for honoring the Lord with his life. And I thought that was really, really neat. So by his mid-30s, he had gotten married. He'd taken a couple journeys through the South. And he saw there, once again, the evils, the darkness of slavery. And so in 1754 and in 1762, he published a couple writings concerning slavery. Quote, he argued for the connection between Christianity and freedom. The idea that men and women are created equal in the image of God leads directly to an idea of general brotherhood and a disposition easy to be touched with the feelings of each other's afflictions. And so even though a lot of his writings were focused on the black slaves and their plight, their situation, he actually extended his thoughts on slavery to include the way that the Native Americans were being treated, the Indians. And so, I mean, again, this was very revolutionary. Look at when he lived, you guys. I mean, early, mid-1700s. This was before all of this stuff was really being talked about, right? The Civil War wasn't for another 100 years. And yet here he is, having these thoughts and starting to communicate some of these radical truths. And so the neat thing is that Woolman didn't just write against slavery. He lived his life in direct protest to it. And you can already see that. You know, whenever he felt like God was convicting him of something, he acted on it. In a practical way, he didn't just say, like, I'm going to just tell everybody about all these great thoughts I'm having. He's like, no, I want to live this out, you know, in the way he conducted his business, you know, and all of that sort of thing. But then in the way he conducted his own personal life. And so, for example, he wore clothes that were undyed without any dye in them because he heard slave labor was used to make dye. He got to the point where he refused to use any product that he knew was made with slave labor. He also refused to stay in the homes of slaveholders. Although the cool thing was, he was very peaceable about it. He wasn't picketing slave owners. He wasn't outside, like, down with these, you know. Anyway, he wasn't doing all this weird stuff. He very peaceably and very quietly just lived his life in protest. For example, one time he was, I guess he must have been traveling or something, but he went to go and stay the night, have dinner and stay the night with some friends or just some people that he knew. And he realized that the Negro servants in the house were actually slaves. And as soon as he found this out, that they weren't actually servants, they weren't like, you know, free, they were actually slaves, he quietly just left the house. He didn't say a word, he just left. He just packed his stuff up and just like, I don't know what he said. I don't know, the bathroom, and then just ran out the door. I don't know what he did, but anyways. So he leaves the house, and his host, when he found out what Woolman had done, he was so convicted that the next day he went and freed all of his slaves. So I thought, how cool that Woolman, you know, Woolman's life was what convicted people. You know, that man was convicted by Woolman's actions. It wasn't by any arguments that he made or because he was just so, like, you know, in his face and persuasive and just, you know, overwhelming or anything like that. he just, you know, he just lived his life, and it caused conviction in other people. And I think that's a really good example, you know, in a lot of ways. Sometimes we could probably use a lot more action, and, well, little less talk, more action, but that's, like, probably not the right connotation for that anyway. So, but it's true, you know, too many words sometimes and not enough just living our lives in according to what we believe. And so Woolman was very unconventional for his time, especially since America, like I said, didn't quite have an awakened conscience to slavery yet, generally speaking. But he was very effective. The Lord really used his sincerity, his personal example, his maturity. He was very spiritually mature in how he handled these things. And because of that, he accomplished a lot. In fact, within 25 years of his death, all of the American Quakers completely abandoned slavery, largely due to his example. And it's cool because later, the Quakers were the ones who led the way in the anti-slavery movement. They were a major help in the Underground Railroad, which we'll talk about in a second. And so it's cool to see, again, one man's example and testimony affecting future generations. So, that's Joan Woolman, and then we have, briefly, very quickly, we'll talk about the next two gals, Sojourner Truth, you might have heard of. She was a former slave-turned-preacher against slavery, and she impacted a lot of people during that very volatile time in American history, the Civil War era.
She was a preacher, is that what you said?
Well, kind of, yeah, she kind of became a preacher against slavery. She grew up in southern New York. She was a slave. She grew up as a slave, like I said, and had very cruel owners. Finally, she escaped when she was 30 years old, ended up being bought by a Quaker couple who then freed her. So I think that's probably what the Quakers ended up doing a lot, you know, rescuing people by buying them and then letting them go. And soon after that, God revealed himself to her. She was transformed by Jesus and the love of God in her life. Her faith was a little bit confused early on. She actually ended up in a couple of cults for a while before she got a fresh start and really got her act together and, you know, started getting more grounded. And then from that point on, she went around preaching the gospel and promoting the end of slavery. In 1850, she published her autobiography, which made her famous, but also a target of the pro-slavery folks. In fact, she would get beat up by mobs and stuff. She was forced to use a cane for the rest of her life after one incident where she got totally mangled. But she carried on. Quote, by the end of the Civil War, Sojourner Truth had met with Abraham Lincoln, and there's a live photo right there of what happened. Had her arm dislocated by a racist streetcar conductor, petitioned the government to make Western lands available for free blacks, and made countless speeches on behalf of African Americans and women. So, there she is, Sojourner Truth. And then, another gal, Harriet Tubman. You can tell this woman means business. So, like Sojourner Truth, Tubman was a former slave that the Lord raised up, not just to speak out, but to actively move against slavery. She was raised as a slave in Maryland. She escaped in 1849. But she wasn't content to just live in freedom up in the North, you know, when she knew that there were so many other people in the South still totally in bondage and in slavery. And so she felt like she needed to do something about it. So she began making trips to the South to help free her fellow slaves. On 19 trips, at least 19 that we know of, she led hundreds of people to freedom. And by helping so many escape, she actually earned the nickname Moses. People began to call her that. Angry slaveholders would post rewards for her capture up to $40,000, which was back then was a lot of money, but she was never caught. Tubman had a great strategy for rescuing the slaves. She would only make her rescue attempts in the winter, because obviously, you know, as you move further north and it gets real snowy, the weather is more treacherous, and so it would be easier to cover your footprints with snow, but also it would be less likely that somebody would be able to follow and pursue you. It would make that more difficult. So she would make rescue attempts in the winter, and what she would do is she would go and send messages to the slaves to meet her several miles from their plantation on a Saturday night, because, even though the slaves had a hard and brutal life, they were always given Sunday off because it was the Sabbath, and of course all of these wonderful plantation owners and everything, they went and honored God and went to church on Sundays and gave everybody else the day off. So she figured, if you come, you know, meet me on a Saturday night, we'll get moving. We'll have over 24-hour head start. By the time they find out that you're gone, it'll be Monday morning and we'll already be, you know, on our way. And so, smart move, right? So she had a good little strategy going there. And she would meet them Saturday night. They'd make their way up north and to freedom. Quote, because her rescue missions were fraught with danger, Tubman demanded strict obedience from her fugitives. A slave who returned to his master would likely be forced to reveal information that would compromise her mission. If a slave wanted to quit in the midst of a rescue, Tubman would hold a revolver to his head and ask him to reconsider. Like, dang, girl. I mean, look at her. I mean, you can see her, like, photo of a guy. Might want to reconsider that.
So
I know. I love it, but, I mean, that's what she had to do. She's like, really, I would rather you die than risk all these other people's lives. I mean, I don't know if she actually would have pulled it. I mean, she never had to, because they were like, you know. Felt like she meant business. And so, oh, that's her on the far left there. This is her family. Some other slaves and stuff. I think that's her husband. I'm not sure. Yeah, I know. The 1800s photos, everybody always looks creepy because they had to, like, stay in one position for, like, an hour while they took the picture. So, anyway, so her little system of rescuing slaves eventually earned the nickname the Underground Railroad because it seemed like the slaves would disappear underground. And most people thought, you know, I remember I used to think that the Underground Railroad was like a subway system because that's just, you know, you don't know what that means. But now you know. If you didn't know that before, the Underground Railroad was just, it wasn't a literal railroad. It was just the escape route of the slaves. And so this became a very, again, a very famous, well-established system throughout all those volatile days before and during the Civil War. The neat thing about all this is that Harriet Tubman said she listened to the voice of the Lord to tell her where she should go as she led the slaves up north. And I think that's why, I'm assuming that's why she was never caught. She really, like, just prayed and asked God to just lead every step. She didn't want to make a move apart from his direction. In fact, she had such confident faith in God and his leading that one guy said, I never met any person of any color who had more confidence in the voice of God. During the Civil War, she was a nurse, a laundress, a spy for the Union Army. And even though, this is interesting, even though there were a lot of honors, you know, presented to her for her ministry and for her work, she died in poverty, very quietly, in New York. So that's Harriet Tubman, and then we have Harriet Beecher Stowe. So we're ending with a whole bunch of women here tonight. Just kind of throwing them out there. She's definitely one of the most famous names associated with the slavery issue because she wrote the greatest anti-slavery novel in history, Uncle Tom's Cabin, not Uncle Ben. All right, so... this book is so significant that it's... This is interesting. The circulation of Uncle Tom's Cabin, the editions and the printings of Uncle Tom's Cabin, is probably only exceeded by the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress over the course of history. I mean, maybe by today's standards, you know, a lot of books are, like, thrown out. But this was, like, printed in so many editions. Again, it's, you know, it's, like, in third place behind the Bible and Pilgrim's Progress. I thought that was really amazing. One of her harshest critics said it was perhaps the most influential novel ever published, a verbal earthquake and ink and paper tidal wave. And again, we're seeing a godly Christian making an impact, not just on the church, but on the world around her in this case. So Harriet was born in Connecticut to another famous Christian named Lyman Beecher. I think he was in your book, wasn't he? Did you guys read about Lyman Beecher? Yeah, okay. He was a real key figure. As a theologian and... I was confusing them with another family that were anti-slavery people. But anyway, Lyman Beecher. She was very sharp, very intelligent. She got saved when she was pretty young. Her family moved to Ohio when she was 21. She met Calvin Stowe. They got married when she was 25. They stayed in Ohio until 1850. And during that time, Harriet was first exposed to the Underground Railroad. Because they lived in one of the free northern towns connected with the Underground Railroad, this, you know, the little escape route. And so the Stowes were very aware of that fact. You know, it went right through their town, you know, the whole route right down their street. In fact, they began to get involved in helping the slaves in their escape. And so Harriet was very sympathetic to their plight, especially as a Christian, because she really believed everyone was created equal in the sight of God. You know, there's no slave or free, you know, no Jew, Gentile, all that sort of thing. And so she really believed, like, you know, these people need to be free. And so Harriet always had a gift for writing. And so one day her sister said to her, if I could use a pen as you can, I would write something that will make this whole nation feel what an accursed thing slavery is. And Harriet was like, wow, I don't know about that. I mean, she didn't feel inspired to write anything when her sister said this. It wasn't like, that's such confirmation. I was already thinking that. No, I mean, she was just kind of like, wow, that's quite a tall order. I don't know about that. But it's neat because soon after this, during a communion service at church, she suddenly had this vision of Uncle Tom's triumphant death. And so drawing from this and her experiences with the Underground Railroad, she began to just throw a few notes together, showed them to her husband, and with tears in his eyes, he handed it back to her and he said, this is it. This is a book. You've already started it. I mean, just go for it, honey. So she was like, okay. So she began to write. I thought that was so cool. You'll never hear about that in history class, but Uncle Tom's Cabin was inspired during a church service. So that is quite simply how it came into being. It became an instant hit, first as a magazine series and then as a book in 1852, which turned Harriet into a celebrity almost overnight. And yet, in the midst of her whirlwind rise to fame, Harriet always gave credit to the Lord for writing the book, because she knew, again, she wasn't inspired to do this of her own accord. It wasn't like she had all these ideas and stuff to write. She knew, like, God gave me a vision of what to write during church. This was his idea. The book itself speaks the gospel very clearly. For example, the hero of the novel is a slave who, as Harriet said, quote, grew up without Christian light or knowledge. One sermon, one offer of salvation by Christ was sufficient for him to make him at once a believer from the heart and a preacher of Jesus. And so that's in the book. You know, I mean, it talks about the Lord right there. So, again, it's pretty clear, but not something they're going to highlight in a U.S. history class. They might mention Uncle Tom's Cabin because it was very significant, but not, you know, the whole background of how it came to be and what it was really all about. So, soon, Uncle Tom's Cabin was not just a national success, it went international as well. Within a year, Harriet and her husband were being invited to go to England, where she met everyone from the Archbishop of Canterbury to Charles Dickens. I mean, just pretty random. That's always weird to me when you're reading one person's biography and you hear about some other famous person that they meet. You're like, oh yeah, I forget, these guys were all contemporaries. You know, they all lived at the same time. So, she goes back to the U.S., finds herself being put to the forefront of the anti-slavery movement as it's really starting to gain momentum here. We're, you know, again, we're in the mid-late 1850s. It's really starting to heat up, leading up to the Civil War. She drafted an anti-slavery petition to present to Congress. As Lincoln became president, the Civil War began. She continued to crusade against slavery. She even countered Lincoln himself once in the newspaper. She's like, I disagree with the president. You know, I don't know what she said. I can't remember. I think I had it written down at one point. But apparently he was really impressed with her, because later when they met, he made this famous statement. So this is the little lady who made this big war. That was something Lincoln said to her. And in a way, that's kind of true, because slavery had become a dominant issue. Even though it wasn't the original initial issue at the heart of the matter, it had become a major social problem and, again, issue that was being addressed. In fact, it's been said that Uncle Tom's Cabin was the wedge that finally rent asunder the gigantic fabric of American slavery with a fearful crash. And so when Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, a lot of people gave some credit to Harriet as well, because she was a major force in bringing that about. And so in a way, you could say Harriet Beecher Stowe was in America kind of like what William Wilberforce was in England in terms of the slave issue and the influence that she held. So God really used her in a big way. And then we end up with this gal right here. I'm going to wrap up really quickly with Elizabeth Fry. And this kind of transitions us out of the anti-slavery movement into addressing issues created by the Industrial Revolution. Remember what I said. It was a revolution. It just turned society totally topsy-turvy, upside down. People weren't prepared to deal with or equipped to deal with all of this, the issues of urbanization that were created. And so Elizabeth Fry was one of these figures that God used during this time. She was probably one of England's most significant prison reformers of all things. You probably would not think that of her if you look at this little lady here, but she's a really important prison reformer in England. There she's up there on the £5 note, which is still in circulation. I use those all the time when I go over there. I always see Elizabeth Fry's little face and it makes me happy. So, like Joan Woolman, she was, I think this is just amazing. You know, if you ever go to England, it's just amazing the Christian heritage and the depth that they have there. I mean, it's just this rich heritage and they're just so unaware and agnostic now, and not, you know, into the things of God, you know, just as an English society in general. You know, you'll find pockets of people that are, you know, that the Lord's working and definitely moving in, but, you know, there's just to a large extent, it's like, wow, they have no idea, they're just so blind, you know, and cold to the Lord. But anyway, not in Elizabeth Fry's days, it was different. So, like John Woolman, she was raised a Quaker. And again, it's cool. The Quakers were so proactive in society during this time, you know, not just in the slavery movement, but in other parts too. So she didn't really come to know the Lord personally until she was 18. But then when she did, later that same year, a friend prophesied over her and said, "You are born to be a light to the blind, speech to the dumb, and feet to the lame." And Elizabeth was like, "I don't know about that." She was super skeptical. Like, I'm just little me. I don't think I'm going to really do that much. But God did use her in a powerful way. So as a young Christian, she began to just serve the Lord in practical ways. And that's what, if you read her life and her story, you see that that was really what was characteristic of her life. It was her relationship with the Lord. It was a very practical one. She married Joseph Fry in 1800, started raising a family. Years later, in 1812, a friend of the family, the Fry family, visited the women's section of this large prison in London called Newgate Prison. You can see the site of it. There's still a little plaque on the wall of this building. It says site of the original Newgate Prison. It was one of the biggest prisons in London, if not the largest. And he was horrified by what he saw. And so he came to the Fry's house and he described to them all that he had seen. And Elizabeth's like, "It can't be that bad. I need to go see this for myself." And so she goes to the prison and she was shocked by what she saw in the women's section of the prison. There were 300 women and children crammed into four large rooms. Four rooms. Could barely fit all of them. And you had all kinds of women in there all together. You have women that basically were only thrown in there because they were in debt. It was called debtor's prison, right? They had debtor's prison back then where if you owed money, you were thrown in there. And it didn't matter why. You know, maybe your husband was out of work or broke his leg or had died and you're trying to raise the kids and pay the rent and you can't do it anymore. Tough. You know, if you had an unmerciful landlord, you would get thrown in prison. So you have all of these women who are really basically innocent and haven't done anything wrong, right next to hardened criminals and prostitutes, and I mean, everybody's just all crammed in together. It was so nuts. And then not only that, but sometimes what they would do is, if a woman had kids and was being thrown into debtor's prison, and there's nobody to watch the children or take care of them, then they just had to go with her. So you have all these little kids in prison, too, with their moms. It was so bizarre. You know, you got women that are just drunk and filthy. Some of them were so tough, they even shocked the male prisoners. And the kids weren't that well off, either. They're sleeping on the floor with everybody. Newborn babies were lying naked on the floor of these cold cells. And again, you know, you don't want to be lying naked anywhere in an English winter. That's just like, terrifying. And that's just kind of really awkward, but anyway. In one instance, Elizabeth saw two ladies taking the clothes off a dead baby to put them on another one that was still alive. And so there's like no regard for life, I mean, no sanitation. It was just really horrible. I mean, she couldn't believe what she saw. But again, this is a great picture of what it was like during the Industrial Revolution because everything was chaotic. Things changed so fast in society that nobody knew how to handle it. Nobody was equipped. There weren't any laws to try to orderly manage things. It was just, you know, I just got to deal with all of this right now because we have all these people here. And so it was a really crazy scene. Quote, "Bathing utensils were scarce, lice swarmed in clothes and hair. The daily ration of food was one small loaf of bread per person. There was no medicine. Sick women were dumped on dirty straw without so much as a bed. Death by prison fever, which we now know as typhoid, was common." So a really horrible scene. And so Elizabeth, being the very practical woman that she was, like I said, that was the mark of her relationship with the Lord. It was a very practical one, the way she served him, the way she served others. She decided to take a few other gals with her and go and start visiting and ministering to these people. And so she brought practical things like clothes for the babies, clean straw for people to sleep on. By the third time she visited, the women began to see that she actually really cared about them. Like, oh, Elizabeth's here, you know, first, right, what did she bring us? But then they started to realize, like, wow, she really is invested, you know, she really loves us and really is concerned. And so by the third time she visited, they actually let her pray for them. Amazingly, and you totally see the hand of God in this, they responded so well to her desire to help them that she was able to start a school for the kids and reform activities for the women themselves. Because again, some of them, yeah, maybe some of them were innocent women, but there were also a lot of, you know, prostitutes and gals who had just been living on the streets and didn't know any other skills or know how to cope in life, you know. And so she's like, hey, if you ever get out of here, let's go ahead and, you know, teach you some skills so that you don't have to go back to that life again. And so she taught them to sew quilts, make things to sell for food and other necessities, things that weren't being provided by the prison guards. But most importantly, it got to the point where Elizabeth came into the prison every day and read the Bible to the women. because she knew the gospel alone was what could truly transform them. She's like, I can do all this stuff to help you externally, but at the end of the day, you need a change of heart. You need Jesus. And so that's actually what's in the picture there. You can see, I don't know if you can see her in the middle of that gold kind of dress. She's sitting there reading the Bible with others looking around her. So she said, nothing short of the Holy Spirit can really help forward the cause of righteousness on earth. Amen to that. So by simply presenting God's word to the women, God began to move in their lives. And it wasn't long before people began to notice that something was happening in the women's prison at Newgate. The women were being so transformed. I mean, that the English authorities, the government started to get involved, the prison governor, the Lord Mayor of London. They came in to hear Elizabeth read the Bible to the prisoners. And you got to think, I mean, they were shocked at what they saw. Originally, these were women that were like I said, cussing out the prison guards, and the male prisoners were freaked out by these women. They were so tough and hard and crazy. And now they're all just sitting around sewing quilts and listening to Elizabeth read the Bible. I mean, it's like, what just happened here? This is like a totally transformed group of women. And so simply because of her obedience to the Lord and all of this, God began to open doors. Just like we saw with William Carey and some of these other people we've looked at, you know, you just take those faithful little steps, God begins to do all this other stuff. I mean, she wasn't trying to make any of this happen, but God began to do great things. In 1818, she was invited to give evidence on the state of London's prisons before the House of Commons as like an expert witness kind of a thing. It's like, okay, so there she is in Parliament there. Eventually, a member of the House became a big supporter of her work and came alongside her to start legislating reform in the prison system. Really crazy stuff. Again, nothing she sought out. The Lord just naturally opened these doors because she was obedient to just start going in and bring clothes and straw to the women. It's like amazing. She established an organization for the women at Newgate and realized that God wanted to expand the work, so she started visiting prisons all over Scotland and England. In 1827, she published a book about her findings, and her work inspired other women to establish committees and go into the prisons in their towns. Not only that, but she set up visiting societies to work with the poor. She also established a training school for nurses where women were expected not just to tend to physical needs, but spiritual ones as well. And her nursing school was so effective that the great Florence Nightingale, who you guys might have heard of, famous nurse, British nurse during the Crimean War, she actually is kind of the foundation of modern nursing. Or laid the foundation of modern nursing. She took a group of Elizabeth Fry's nurses with her because they were so great to have along. So by now, Elizabeth Fry had become quite well-known across the nation. Even Queen Victoria met with her on several occasions, and people usually think that she was, you know, because Queen Victoria was quite young at this time, and Elizabeth Fry being an older woman was it was an influential figure in the young queen's life. And yet, in spite of the fame and honor given to her, she always left people with a clear understanding that this was the Lord's work. One man said, I've seen Elizabeth Fry in Newgate. I've witnessed there the miraculous effects of true Christianity on the most depraved of human beings. And she herself told the House of Lords in 1835, I feel it to be the bounden duty of the government and the country that those truths in the Bible should be administered in the manner most likely to conduce to the real reformation of prisoners. For though severe punishment may, in a measure, deter them and others from crime, it does not amend and change the heart. And she hit the nail on the head right there. She knew, like, yes, we can go in and do all this work, but they need their hearts changed. And that's only going to happen by the gospel, the power of the gospel. You know? So, again, the balance that these people had to know that, yes, we want to change and help people in their circumstances, but that they need the gospel so that their lives will be completely transformed. You know, they understood there was a need for both. You know, and to meet the needs of the whole person, you know, because God created the whole man and wants to redeem the whole man. And so I thought that was just really awesome. So that's Elizabeth Fry. We'll finish looking at a few more Christian activists next week, and then that'll lead, then from there we'll wrap up the time period looking at some of the more negative liberal aspects of what was happening in the church and society, because that bridges us into the modern era. So let's pray. Lord Jesus, thank you so much for these lives and for these testimonies. And again, these are just people, Lord, we know that. They are just men and women. But they made themselves available to a great and extraordinary and mighty God. And we thank you that you are the same yesterday, today, and forever. You're that same God that they served. And you want to do great and mighty things in our day, God. You know, you're not limited, Lord, and we don't want to limit you. We want to have great faith in what you can do as we just present ourselves to you, Lord.
daily, Lord, as living sacrifices before you, God. We pray that you would use us on whatever level, Lord. If we're just going to lay foundations for somebody else, Lord, or if you're going to have us reap the harvest, Lord, we want to just be available and open and willing to whatever you call us to do. So thank you so much for these lives. I just pray you would use them to encourage and bless these guys as they go on from here the rest of their week. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, guys.